could you tell me a little bit about your play, A Perfect Ganesh?
It's a play I wrote, I think, 20 years or so ago. I'm not very good on dates exactly when I wrote it, but close to that. And it was a play, it's a play about two women who decide to break the ritual of every year in the winter going to a nice, comfortable spa or golf resort with their husbands. And when the men don't want to embark on an adventure, they decide to go to India on themselves. And they're both middle-aged women. And the children are grown up, so they're not needed at home. So they can go off to India on their own for a month. And this is their adventures in a culture that is completely foreign to them, exotic, challenging, exhilarating. And it's what happens to them and how changed they are when they come back.
So what inspired you to write that play in the first place?
Oh, a couple of things. The first would be my own impressions of India. Though I did not write this play for 3 or 4 years after my first trip to India, I wrote two other plays. In fact, I sat down when I came back from India and wrote Frankie and Johnny and the Clair de Lune, which is one of my better-known plays. It's been made into a movie as well. So it took a while for this play to come out, but I was very struck by two real women I met while I was in India, Americans, who had left their husbands. They were middle-aged and their children were grown up, and they'd left the comforts of home behind to embark on this trip to India for a month, which they were finding challenging, I guess is the best way to put it. I met them in a coffee bar and we spoke for maybe 15 minutes. Then my bus was going somewhere and their train was going somewhere and I never saw them again. But the pluck and valor of their making this voyage stayed with me, I guess. So when I began to write the play, it seemed that's a good vessel. Two women who have been uprooted from everything that's comfortable for them. And then, of course, the women became my own characters, probably my own feelings about my own mother, women, middle-aged, all those things.
So it's inspired by two real-life characters, but the
inspired in the sense just an incident, yeah.
Yeah,
The two women are not based on these women. I only met them for 15 minutes in a coffee bar.
No, I just wanted to ask you, because the themes of the play are much more deeper than just on the superficial level, we have two women going on holiday.
That's the plot.
Yeah. On a deeper level, it's more about they've got secrets that they need to come to terms with.
Well, they have not so much secrets as great guilts and unresolved, undischarged feelings about things that have happened to them in their life, both of which they are responsible for. So they're looking for a certain amount of healing. Both of them have lost a son in very different circumstances. One lost an adult son who was gay-bashed, and she had rejected him because he was gay. And the other lost her firstborn when he was 5 years old because she struck him in a park, and he pulled away from her and ran into the road and was hit by a car. So these are, which is a story that no one knows. Margaret has never told Catherine about this.
Right. The sort of main protagonist in the story is Ganesh, who is the Indian god to remove obstacles and so on. Why did you pick him as a way of getting these women to come to terms with their unresolved issues from the past?
Well, I think like many Westerners who go to India, we fall in love with Ganesh. There's something so appealing about him, this little boy's body and this huge elephant's head, and he travels on a rat and as his coach and his chariot, and he's just very, very appealing. And I didn't give it a lot of thought. He just seemed to be the god. I felt he's very comfortable to a Westerner, where Shiva is a little scary, I think.
What did you make of the current production that's on at the moment?
Oh, I thought it was terrific. They did a lovely job with it. And it's very exciting for me as an American playwright to come to England and see all these British theater artists coming together to put on a play of mine. And especially when I wrote some time ago, you know, it's a golden oldie, I hope.
Well, there was a production in the UK some 10 years ago at the West Yorkshire Playhouse.
Yes, right? That Jude Kelly
directed,
yes.
Did you get a chance to see that?
Yes, I saw that, and that was a wonderful production too.
I wanted to ask you about the Indian characters in the story. The way that the play is structured is that you have mm-hmm. two female characters, And you have the god Ganesh, who appears as a god sometimes, and he appears as in a human disguise sometimes. Mm-hmm. Then you have another person who plays a role called Man, but mm-hmm. Man is several roles, sometimes as an air steward, sometimes a hotel attendant, sometimes it's Walter, Catherine's sons from the past. I just wanted you to talk a little bit about when you were writing it and you just have this thing called Man. You mm-hmm. know, what is that character representing overall?
Right. Well, I like to play with different forms of theater, and I like actors coming up with playing six or seven or even more parts in the course of an evening. I don't think this play would be well served by hiring 30 or 40 actors to play all of it, because I'm sure Man plays close to 20 parts if you counted them. And Ganesh plays many other parts too. In the very first scene, he gets on the plane, and it looks like a British businessman with his rolled-up umbrella, and they see him as that. They don't see that the women don't always see the divinity in the person they're talking to. So that's why I've split the parts. Also, Man, but I'm not making, all it means is actor, maybe is a better word than man. He does not represent all men, or he's not every man. It's just a theatrical device, which I found fun. It's the only play I've ever done it in, and I think it was a lot of fun to use it.
See, because one of the interpretations being offered was that the man character is like the obstacles that the women have to go through to come to their own sort of emotional catharsis.
That's true, but I don't think, as soon as you say that, I say, yes, you're absolutely right, but when I was writing the play, I didn't think that. It just, that's where part of writing is intuitive, and we leave it to critics or audiences, or sometimes we have our own insight after we finish the play. But the man is very much the obstacles, and Ganesh is always the one who whether he appears as a hotel clerk or a travel guide, helps the women in when their trip is in trouble.
Can I just ask you, in this production of A Perfect Ganesh that's currently on, the characters of Catherine and Margaret have been rendered into like English women from mm-hmm. kind of the suburbs.
Right.
Do you feel that made any difference to the original storytelling? Were you quite happy with seeing that interpretation?
I was very happy because it's just the change was the names of things. So where they're from in the American edition of the text becomes a British suburb, you know. So it really was, to me, a very minor change. And if it makes the play more accessible to a British audience, then I'm very happy. When we did the play at the Leeds Playhouse, it was done, they were American women. Mm-hmm. And maybe the actors are a little more comfortable. And the audience, but as playwright, I did not feel, oh, how dare they change it to. And the director asked for permission anyway, and said it sounds fine. Rewriting the play, you know, to accommodate a British audience, I would take umbrage with, because characters should be universal enough in what they're experiencing mm-hmm. that an audience feels comfortable with them. But to change the name of something does not bother me at all, from where they're from or towns and place names. Okay. It's probably a good idea, in fact.
In terms of when Margaret and Catherine talk about their past and everything, you realize that Catherine's son has been beaten up by a group of men who end up being black, and, mm-hmm. and Margaret's son was sort of killed by a woman who's also of black.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering if you wrote them as literally as black characters, or is this the fear of those two women, you know, their own kind of racism that makes them believe that this is what it is?
Well, I think it's the kind of racism that's almost self-fulfilling, in that the people who, the men who killed her son were black, or that a black woman happened to be driving the car. But as Ganesh says, why not? But I think racism is something that we all have to deal with. And whether we demonize people who are different than us by calling them black, or maybe they indeed, in my mind, literally she's telling the truth. The six men driving by who made fun of her son, and he challenged them and was beaten to death for his efforts, I think realistically were black. But I think it's in term of, it's in keeping with the themes of the play, that the unknown is something that to be very frightened of, and I think the racism inherent in these women is there, and that's something that India, and she has to exercise herself of that when she has that scene at the river where she's calling names out, and she has to exercise herself for the hate from the hatred she feels of people who are different than her, which comes out of a sense of she's unable to really deal with the loss of her son, and she really is those men who beat him up. She is the homophobe in the play, who rejected her son, not the strangers who beat him to death. They were almost incidental, or they were her, as the son says, you know, those six men are you. And I think that's very important. These are her fears and neuroses. And because it's not a realistic play, I think that's probably why it came out that way. You know, when I'm not a schematic writer, but when I sat down and say, oh, the five or six teenagers who beat her son to death, they have to be black, or the woman driving the car has to be black. It just came out that way. So I think intuitively I was dealing with probably my own racism as well. I think, you know, it's pretty hard to grow up in society and be impervious to things like racism. At least I find that true for myself.
Okay, another one of your plays that was on in the UK, it was on in Edinburgh some 10 years ago, is a play called Corpus Christi, which caused controversy, I think, when it came down for its London run at the Pleasance. I just wondered if you would care to talk a little bit about that piece.
Well,
why did you write it initially? What drew you to write it? You know, you talked the other day that you felt you were writing it as a passion play.
A passion play, so... As there's a spoken prologue to the play, he says, you all know how, one of the characters says, you know how this story ends, therefore there's no suspense. So what it is a retelling of the life of Christ, in which he is a gay man, and the apostles are gay men. And I think that came from a desire to reclaim the spiritual, for gay men and women to be able to reclaim their spiritual history. It's Christianity is... Certainly the United States has, for the most part, made us feel unwelcome in its churches and its theology. And this is my attempt to say, no, we own this story as much as you do. I did not expect the controversy that ensued. Perhaps it was naive of me, but I was quite surprised when it erupted. There was a certain amount of misinformation being disseminated at the time about what the play was actually about and what an audience could expect, which was never true. Most of it was really sexual stuff, saying that there was onstage orgies, and it was never the intention of the play. It's a rather deeply personal and deeply spiritual play, and that those kind of things were never part of the play. And then when the play was seen, these same idiots then said, oh, well, he cut it all out because of our pressure, and not one word of that play was changed in rehearsal other than to make it a better text.
So it was originally going to be put on at the Manhattan Theatre.
And it was put on there, yes.
I mean, initially the Manhattan Theatre Club said that they wouldn't be able to put it on because their sponsorship was withdrawn.
Their sponsorship, and also they feared for safety of their audience members, since there were many bomb threats made to the theatre. So the solution, which I thought was a very unhappy one, was that the play was done, but only its members of the Manhattan Theatre Club, which is really a subscription theatre, only its subscribers were allowed to see the play, so you could not have bought a ticket for Corpus Christi had you been in New York. The general public was not allowed in, so they felt this was a way of controlling the audience in any kind of terrorism or physical violence. And then the play ran for about 4 or 5 weeks, whatever their run is, their subscription run. The audience had to go through metal detectors. There were police dogs sniffing around, and I forget what other handicaps there were to enjoying the performance, but they were there. And there was pickets outside the theater every night. Pro and con, I'm happy to say, the New York theater community supported me. And the playwright who first stepped forward and said, if you're going to cancel this play, then you can't do my play after, and it was Athol Fugar. He was the first playwright to say, because his play was followed mine in the theater in their subscription season. He said, fine, you cancel this play, you cannot have the rights to my play. And I can't tell you how much I admired his action, because words, it's true, words are a bit cheap. That's a real action. It's hard to get a play done in New York City these days, a serious play. And certainly Athol Fugar's plays are demanding and serious. They're not commercial. So for him to be willing to forego a production... as a show of camaraderie with me, was enormously important and set me a great example to put my to put my money where my mouth is.
So 10 years later, I mean, your show is still being performed.
It's being done.
I read somewhere that it was on earlier this year in Sydney, is that right?
Sydney, yes, and it was done very successfully in Edinburgh again this past summer, and it was held over, and instead of playing for 1 week, they were asked to stay for 2 more weeks, and it ran for 3 full weeks in Edinburgh, which is, they're the only play that was asked to be held over. And this production is coming to Dublin this spring in May or June. I believe it's in June, May, so I'm going to go over for that.
So can you tell us a little bit about what's coming up for you when you go back to New York? What are you doing? What will you be doing?
The next thing I'll be doing is a musical I've worked on with Kander and Ebb. It's the last score that John Kander and Fred Ebb finished before Fred Ebb died, and it's a musicalization of Dürrenmatt's play The Visit, and we're going to do it in Washington. At a theater that's devoted just to doing new musicals premiere. And with luck, God's willing, it will move to New York eventually. But this is a chance to see it on its feet with a wonderful cast. Cheetah Rivera, who's a multiple Tony Award winner, is starring. And George Hearn, who's also a multiple Tony Award winner. It's quite a starry group of people. The director has won Tony Awards, the choreographer, Anne Reinking, who created the role in Chicago, this successful revival as choreography. So we have hopes for this. And then I have a new play called Unusual Acts of Devotion, which I hope will be beginning its trip to New York in Philadelphia this fall with a production. My most recent play in New York was called Some Men, and that play began in Philadelphia. It's a lovely space there, and plays need nurturing and development. It's very risky to just open a play cold in New York, as we did with Corpus Christi. It's very, very risky. And it was very hard to do the work, because most new plays do need work from the playwright. And it's very hard working on Corpus Christi with all the brouhaha going on outside.
So is it very difficult to work in what you might call the kind of off-Broadway theater sector in America?
It's still difficult to get your work done in New York, even off-Broadway. Off. And I think it's even plays by Edward Albee, or he's probably our leading elder statesman playwright now. He took him almost 10 years to get Three Women produced. So it is, right now, money is very, very tight.
Even if you're a well-known name.
Yes. Arthur Miller has had 3 unproduced plays in New York City when he died a couple of years ago. And they still haven't been done in New York. You think if Arthur Miller can't get his latest script on, because of the economy, I think there's many more revivals than is ideal. And it's very risky to do new plays. I mean, 1 in 100 are usually successful. The mortality rate with new plays is very, very high. So producers say we've got to provide hits for our audience, and it's safer to do a revival of Chicago than it is to do a brand new musical. And that's just the way it is. But if the work is good, it gets done eventually. So you just have to hang in there.
So you write plays and musicals, and I know that you've written a TV film as well. What is the form that you enjoy working in the most?
Theater, no question. And I enjoy musicals, and I enjoy my own plays. It's just the difference is my musicals are adaptations. They're based on something else. The only original musical I've ever done was The Rink. All the others have been based on a play, a novel, a film. And when it's a play, I'm solely responsible for it. When it's a musical, it's a collaboration with a lyricist and a composer. But that doesn't mean I enjoy it less. But when you see Ragtime, and I'm very proud of Ragtime, I think it's a great show, we're trying to honor Doctorow. I can't take credit for those. I did not create those characters, but I hope I gave it a shape and form and a real foundation for Lynn and Stephen to write great songs. But we're all honoring Doctorow. He's the source of Ragtime. And just as Manuel Puig is the source of Kiss of the Spider Woman, or Friedrich Dürrenmatt will be the source of The Visit.
So as a writer, how do you work? Do you sort of get up every day and work for several hours on a typewriter or something?
Oh, I should. I don't, though. No, but when I'm engaged, as I am now, with 2 or 3 projects around, I usually get to the keyboard every day and get something done.
Right.
But I think writing is a muscle, and the more you use it, the better you get.
Okay, thank you very much, Terence.
Thank you.